is my oldest daughter. It is 8:04 a.m. Thursday, February 27th, 2020, in Capitol Room 106. Members present are Representative Tallarico, Representative Lincoln, Representative Cortez, Representative Flint, and myself, Representative Lukowski, Chair. Let the record reflect that we have a quorum to conduct business. If everyone could take this moment to silence your cell phones for the duration of the meeting. Before we begin, as always, I'd like to thank Jamie Beeman, the House Tribal Affairs Secretary for moderating the bridges for the General Assembly for staffing the committee today. This morning, we're going to be having conversations about equity in Alaska, focusing on evaluating equity in Alaska through the framework of peace law that's taking place. So we'll begin by turning our attention to testimony from Robert Pinky, an attorney with the law firm Holland & Knight, for a discussion about the case of Kasaya versus State. Mr. Pinky, are you on the line? Good morning. If you could begin by introducing yourself on the record and begin your presentation.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chairman. And good morning, everybody. My name is Alan Tribute. I'm attorney for the practicing law for 4 years Thank you. Thank you.
question, Mr. Kennedy, Representative Harris.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just trying to get a high-level view of this case. My understanding, it wasn't until 1990 that I guess everything was worked out, but can you tell me the difference between what was accomplished with this case versus the Molly, is it the Molly Hooch case?
That's the actual Thank you. don't even understand the infrastructure of fuel that they have.
Are there any questions from committee members? Representative Lopez?
Briefings.
Briefings.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Earlier in your explanation on the Kasani case, was there a reference or did it refer to a different case in relationship to rural districts' incentives or directives for rural districts, party any districts to form boroughs? As a part of the solution to getting adequate funding for construction purposes, school construction purposes, etc. Did you say something about that?
Yes, let me explain.
A copy of the letter that you sent in 2019 to the governor and the attorney general included in those documents. Thank you so much for your testimony this morning. If you don't mind kind of hanging on the line in the event that additional questions come to me in the direction of the committee, like to invite Ms. Malkia, Barbara Blake, the Theoretical Community Policy Center, to the testifier table. She will continue in discussion on the topic of equity in rural Alaska. Ms. Blake, if you could introduce yourself for the record and begin your testimony.
It's an honor to be with you today. We're finding an opportunity to own. My name is Wilfred Dedox. And if you have difficulty hearing me, I'm not saying that. The rough is my pressure to get rid of your mouth and blow out the side of your cheeks. Wilfred Dedox, I think it's pretty easy. So. And if you have difficulty speaking that, Barbara Blake, if that's the title, you can keep on. My name is Barbara Blake. Director of the Community Policy Center at the First Lessons Institute. My family is from Heidelberg. I'm a Yakutinos, a reader from the Sherkos. My grandmother's people are Haiti, or the Maxan people from Kulak. My father's people are Katina from Kistina, Alaska, and every time I say Kistina, I always say Alaska after, and I don't know why I do that. Katina, the Skyline, or the Anna people from the interior of the north of Anchorage. I brought my name up when to bring my ancestors into the room because that's how we introduce ourselves when we give our lineage. We're also asking our ancestors to join us as we provide information or we speak to the public venue that our ancestors are with us in these instances. But too, I also wanted to kind of raise kind of an epiphany that I had at one point in my past. When I was speaking to a gentleman from Greenland, and he said, "Wilfred Dedox, that's a beautiful name. Why don't you use that as your name, Fulton?" And I said, "Well, you know, it's a challenging name. People have often difficulties pronouncing the Wilfred Dedox part." And he said, "Well, your people had to learn an entire language, and you're asking for only one word in yours." And I thought about that. I bring that forward today as, you know, just a token of where inequity lies in my own periphery, and what I don't even see myself on a day-to-day basis living and thriving here in Alaska, is that often in those instances where the blinders have to be removed from my own eyes in order to see that these instances arise quite often, was unexpected for me. It was something where I had to really stop and reflect on myself. And think about that a little bit, because that's pretty profound to think about the fact that I would be asking one word of language that I had to learn and adapt my ancestors had to learn and adapt for simply for an entire way of being. And what I mean by that is it's only like you've gotten some reflection or some overview of the boarding school era for Alaska. The state and church and the first of the group here are people from our culture and our way of knowing how to thrive here in Alaska, be healthy, how to take care of each other, how to take care of ourselves. And that further away, removing who we were from our way of being, shifted our whole trajectory in this place. And a lot of that is still not reflected today. I was thinking about how funny it would be to go to France and demand that everyone in France speak English, but they communicate to me in a way that's only American. That happened here. You know, and that is still existing today in our school systems. There's an erasure that was done, and that kind of still exists, and that inequity that's built into our system and how we operate. And oftentimes, folks don't even realize they're doing it or not even realize what is happening all the times. And it's also kind of opens our eyes and says, hey, like, was that really fair? Was that really equitable? And I have to think to myself, maybe it wasn't. And an instance of that is the robust people that existed here for 10,000 years prior to contact, prior to the pioneers who came here. The pioneers who came here were also robust people because they came to a land that they worked for long. They came to a land where they had to adapt very quickly and how to survive. But people did that for 10,000 years prior to any pioneers coming here. And that history is rarely told. It's rarely celebrated in this state. that history when it comes to our tourism industry is really a component of how we want to put forward our state and history of the state. I spoke when I was asked to be a director for a Disney cruise a few years ago, and our Disney cruise director said, "You can see whatever you want to see down here, get four lectures." So we really want them to be about glaciers. So I spent the day in my Google's presentations, all four of them, for the entire week I would be on this cruise ship. And he came back to me and he said, "Well, we really like one thing to be about the gold rush in Stanley." And I thought for a minute, he's made more of a recommendation for our people, for our last community. The people in this cruise ship industry who are meant to be visiting all these communities are our people that listed as SLPs today. And so I was like, "This is going to be great. I'm going to teach these people about Alaska and cultures. So they're going to know about our foods, our medicines, all this great stuff." And so in his response on the presentation on Gold Rush, I thought, and then I responded, and I said, "Well, I'm happy to give a presentation about the Gold Rush, but I will be giving it from the Alaska Native perspective and talk about the impacts that the Gold Rush had on our people." And he's like, "Well, I thought you could just talk about whatever you want to talk about." Which was nice. Which, in the end, he was mentioning the Gold Rush component of it. Here's our history. It's a shared history that we all have together. And I don't see a problem with that shared history walking, coinciding throughout our school systems and the ability for us to tell our story as a state. There's multiple stories that can be told, and it's important to be able to reflect not only one perspective, but multiple perspectives. When we first moved back to Alaska, I worked in Washington, D.C. for a few years for the Secretary of Agriculture. When we first moved back to Alaska, my son and I went to Fairbanks because I was offered a teaching position at UF. And putting him in a school from Washington, D.C., where he was in preschool to kindergarten in Fairbanks, and walking into his school of parents, and I was so excited to come back home and be a part of anything, because this is home. And walking into his school, and walking down his hallway, and walking into his classroom, I was completely shocked that there was no cultural representation of the Alaskan people who resided in Fairbanks, or any Alaskan Native culture represented in his school at all. It was as if Alaskan Native people didn't exist. And coming to that school and seeing that was a shock to me. And knowing that my little boy may have to walk into a school where his own self was not reflected anywhere. When you have a kid, your eyes open in a different way, right? When you have the responsibility to a greater, to more than just yourself, as legislatures of all your constituents, your eyes open differently, start processing information differently. We moved here to Juneau when I started another job, and we walked into his elementary school there. And the first thing I saw on the wall in his school was a portrait of Elizabeth Branchbridge. And I was like, "How cool is that?" Walking down his hallway, there was artwork along the halls that reflected Northwestern culture, that reflected Nipah culture, the Alaskan culture. It was all reflected there. But at the front door of his classroom, it was a welcome class of 2024, written in English, and right underneath that, written in Cherokee, the same thing. The fact that they knew and they could hold those two cultures side by side and allow for those two cultures to walk hand in hand was a beautiful thing. And I saw his life go from this to opening up into being fully himself, to see himself reflected in the school that he was going to, change his trajectory, change his confidence level, change his ability to want to be at school. Whose culture are our kids learning to be? In our schools, what language are they speaking? There's these two thoughts throughout Alaska where our children are learning Yupik, where our children are able to learn Yupik. But those are far and few between. Can you imagine if all of our cultures were acknowledged or celebrated in this state the same way Hawaiians celebrate Hawaiian culture? The way that when you go to Hawaii, action is often not giving you an answer, right? Folks aren't here thinking they're going to learn about the course. They want to stand land untouched. They only want to, you know, sorry, spoil alert, Call of the Wild the other day, which by the way is about a dog. I thought this week about Mercy for my entry, and it's about a dog. Spoil alert. But he makes a statement in that movie a few times that this land that he's experiencing with his dog has been untouched. It's never been explored. It's never been experienced by anybody in the entire world. And he's you know, experiencing a wilderness. He goes through scouting, he goes up the jacket, you know, he's experiencing that whole brand new life. And I sat there and I was like, wow, another erasure of any of our people walking through there. The fact that that trail in itself was a direct friendship of the Native people showing the Gold Rush folks, the pioneers, how to get to certain places within Alaska or Canada, where you could find gold. Right? But I erasure like that, and that happens so often. Often placed here in Alaska. My boss, Rob, and I were visiting some part of this idea, and just because we've been on this road of talking about boarding schools and talking about it, and we did there on what I mentioned here. We have a lot of these schools in our rural communities, and when they fall below the 25-child number, they have to close. We also have a lot of schools in Anchorage. And throughout urban life, they have over capacity. And teachers are having to scramble to try and figure out how to fit 5 more kids in a classroom that's already overflowing. And what I want to say is to reverse the narrative of why don't our children from our rural schools go to the boarding school? Why don't the kids who are over capacity in our urban schools go to our rural communities instead? All those schools that are having to close the doors that the state paid on the 24. So the abstract cases of what do you want to send our children to a rural community? And if you have to stop and reflect on whether or not you would actually be okay with sending your child to a rural community, say something about how you view those communities or the ability to defend public safety in those communities. Your child getting safe there. If you have to think about that, then you have to question or think about it more than once. Whether or not your child's going to be safe in one of those communities, then you know that there's a vast inequity built into the public safety system there. I know that every minister is elected to think and act and provide votes based on the entirety of Alaska. And I know that every minister thinks that they're doing that. And often, not pointing fingers, but often that's not the case. And give you some guidance for, you know, your inability to recognize, you know, you've got the blinders on and you think you're acting in the best interest of all of us, and when in reality, what some of these votes do is actually harm our communities. The real ID and the fact that our communities don't have DMVs, and by the way, I'm not here, is crying for or against any bill. Just going to put that out there. But the real ID and the fact that our communities don't have people, our communities don't have campuses, is our thing. It's not our own, our people in front. Especially in Southeast, now that we don't have a great system. Our people in the community. And in thinking about those implicit biases, you know, making those decisions, think about the state seal. I was walking by downstairs the other day, and an individual, one of the pages was given into a defense student, was talking about the Navy SEAL. She was going into the printer out there with her, and the big brown guy, you know, in the middle. I was like, oh, here we go, the brown guy. We still have a few thriving farms in Alaska, but it's not as much as some other states that have a full robust system of agriculture, right? But there's no representation of Native people on that SEAL. But it's a really never existed prior to being an outcome. And looking at this, you know, I'm listening to this young man, I'm really glad to hear he doesn't know. He doesn't know to say, oh, you know, by the way, there's a representation of Native people on this, you know, the first people of the state. also thinking about pregnancy that we're working with under the foundation here in Olivia. And at that time, so students had brought in or had introduced or had gotten a list under the education law between existing dog from a husky to an Alaska movie. It was really controversial. I don't know if you remember this, but it was really controversial. And it was funny because the husky was actually a dog that had been introduced to Alaska, right? It's not indigenous to this land. When you say that the Malamute was indigenous to Alaska, the Inuit people had used the Alaska Malamute to take care of their children, the bull strings to help them, and the reindeer, right? So, by the way, I think it's the Alaska Malamute, if you didn't already know. But just in the argument alone, like, in that argument, the deep sleep by Alaska, the Alaska, all those things that the Alaska represents to the pioneers of Alaska, to those people who came to visit here and stayed. It represents a lot to them. Whereas the Alaska Mountain represents a lot to the longer history, the beautiful history of Alaska, the 10,000 plus years history of Alaska. And thinking through that process, of the arguments that are made on both sides. And nobody needs to be inequitable. No one needs to have that bias when they're giving testimony or when they're arguing their reasoning for a vote or for what they see as right. It's very often not intentional. I won't say that everybody is not intentional with that. Some people are actually intentional. But most people just don't know. Like, you know, sure. Like, let's advocate for Dusky because diners are important to Alaska. They don't have to be, you know, they made a lot of change happen here. So why wouldn't we keep it Dusky? Why wouldn't we continue to argue for that? You know, that's a big deal.
Excuse me. Could you help me with the pronunciation of your name?
Yes. Roth. Roth. Rafal. Binok.
Rafal Binok. Apologize, Rafal Binok. I have to look at my finance meeting, but I've appreciated your presentation so far very much.
Thank you. I'm trying to help bring light to the one that already have people who might have done and doesn't understand that's your oratory. Story seems to be the best avenue to really point in that form. People pass along important pieces of our history for 10,000 years is through storytelling. I overheard Bishop Peter saying that we had a testimony a while back about the responsibility of our for-profit institutions. Or maybe he was defending that our for-profit institutions are not social entities, or less than corporations. And I was thinking about the responsibility of government versus a for-profit corporation, right? We're not asking Target to fund all of the Anchorage Police Department in Anchorage. It's not a reality. That's not something we would do because that's a big responsibility of the Alaska. It's constitutionally written that we provide public safety. So it's our responsibility, and when we kind of put that burden on for the back of the for-profit institutions, it kind of seems like out of place. And I was also thinking about that same responsibility and that equity that we think is built into a system when in reality it's often not. And an instance of that is a few years ago when a community harvest permits were issued to Otter Region, which is in Otter Region, which is in and around Golden Island. Community harvest permits were issued for moose, and then a beholder permits that were issued to hunt in our region and hunt moose in that region. Seven went to the people of the region. The rest went to everyone else throughout the state. But I was thinking about how these systems that are supposed to be equitable are preventing my people from going and harvesting the moose to feed his family. Something that most people have paid for 10,000 years. And thinking through how somebody who's driving 3 miles to visit those areas has more right to that moose than my uncle does. It's pretty rough to digest, and it's pretty rough to think about that my uncle can't hunt because somebody else in a system that's equitable deserves that moose more than he does. vaccine processes, you can apply that to multiple different scenarios in the hospital, whether it does with public safety, whether it does with our water and wastewater. And when I worked for a set of implications and I was going to report on water and wastewater in the state, and at that time, more and more homes did not have running water. And of course, 80% of those were in rural communities. And at that time, the amount of money that had been sitting in a pot was in the local millions because the state couldn't figure out how to spend the USDA money accordingly. So there had been a buildup of funds that had been sitting there for a while. And the past few months was all the legislation to figure out how to spend that money really fast because it was going to go away. And so when that money got applied, the percentage that actually went to communities with dumped water and wastewater was 20%. The rest went to communities that already had water and wastewater systems in place. And I sat there thinking, how is that okay when we are operating without money, when one of our homes doesn't have water? How do we spend over $50 million just on communities that already have water and wastewater in place? Doesn't seem right. And then, that was built in the system, but the way that those funds are diverted into our communities was meant to be equitable. It was meant to provide equality throughout the system. I want to provide an invitation to the folks here and to those on the legislature. We'll be having these conversations later individually to see if you'd like to join us. We will be embarking on a series of tribunals over the next 2 years. We, for some aspects of the state, will be hosting two special hearing and examination tribunals throughout the state over the next 2 years. Six of these tribunals, each one beyond the week for a week long, throughout our state, the first one will be this coming June. And these tribunals will be held so that these stories, these instances of the difficulty in these histories that impacted our people so drastically that we cannot overcome them today, will finally be able to live and breathe in today. These stories that have been buried for multiple generations that are still causing trauma within our current generations will finally have the ability to speak their truth out loud. And there's a healing component. The truth, reaching healing, and healing is a huge shift from truth and reconciliation, which is the process that's been used in Canada and Africa and multiple other places around the world. And this process, and the reason we're doing it the way we're doing it, is because in order to be reconciled, in order to reconcile, you have to start from a good place, which really hasn't been the history of a lot of Native people in this state, or this country, for that matter. And so our endeavor is truth, reason, healing, and transformation, so maybe that the truth can be told one of them rather than buried at the time. The reason healing component will be just the healing from these historic harms, or these connecting harms that are still in existence today. Finding out it was the correct ramification. This is why I hope that you will take me up on my offer to attend at least one of these tribunals. The transformative piece will come in the form of how we look at policy, how we look at system change, how we look at legal change in order to make the differences and shifts in our way of life here in Alaska as Alaskans in order to make this whole place better. And I hope that you will consider joining us there because a lot of these stories are just that. The expert that I'm sharing with you today, and there's a lot more that can be spoken to, and it can really help to alleviate the blinders that we often walk around in our lives with. We also have a series of dialogues, Alaska Native Dialogues on Racial Equity, at First Alaskans Institute, where we have these conversations. Whether they be regionally guided, we have these same conversations in more in depth. Conversationally with the Kingman School District, with the Fairfax School District, with the Maxine Peru Pools, and multiple others. And this Alaska Native Dialogue on Racial Equity is another opportunity to dive a little deeper into the world of equity in terms of the surrounding culture that existed here for 10,000 plus years. Larry Burwell, the Echo-Hawk, is a famous attorney. He wrote the book called In the Corner of the Conquer. He's a famous national attorney who is Native American from the South. And in this book, he talks about how Native people can be seen as the canary in the mine shaft. And how if a culture coexists for 10,000 plus years living in one place, it's really impressive. I mean, I don't think that maybe Alaska recognizes or acknowledges how impressive that is to have our indigenous people still on the same land as our ancestors for 10,000 years. Fighting the same beliefs of our ancestors and my ancestor 10,000 years ago or so, that's 450 generations. And thinking through that, why it's not so special is because not a lot of other countries have that same history. I mean, you're talking before the pyramids. There's this proof that Denver people will eat zebra pizza. That's huge. And it's something to be celebrated. But it is pretty cool that these Black Native people who incorporated us inside of the world have that history here. And to bring that into light and to share that history with the world will only make us that much stronger.
During the search with his opening testimony this morning, he was describing how our representative government is designed to make political decisions, or often make decisions based on political representation. And we made a comment in our testimony today that it's important for policymakers to reflect not only perspective but multiple perspectives. Can you dive into a little bit more how implicit bias can impact our ability in seeing those multiple perspectives? You've used that analogy of blinders, but can you maybe define for us what implicit bias is and how it may be unintentionally ingrained in our decision making process?
I spoke with a legislator a few years ago, somebody who was actually asking me about being a favorite student in my district. And I asked him, what would you be looking to do? You know, my program has been on tribal relations, fishing game. And he said, we really don't have any Native people in our district. You know, I just know that you're a star worker. And I just laughed and I had to back up a little bit and say, you don't have any Native people in your district. You sure you have Native people in your district? And that implicit, you know, just the understanding that we're trying to have that existence, that place priority, and to bring them in. And implicit bias in his decision making is the same thing. What he might be enacting on is what he thinks is best for his district. And thinking that there are no Native people in my district, so I don't have to make a decision that's going to impact Native people or not. So I think about being what I need for this decision. This is not accurate. And every decision that's being made has an impact. When you choose to defend policy as a state dog, thinking that you are defending the pioneers of Alaska, doesn't implicit bias because you're not seeing the fact that there were other people here, that there were other animals here prior to that you had that ability to have a history of your own. If you're only choosing to look straight ahead and not choosing to see the other facets of that decision making that should be impacting your decisions, you're not making a decision with your eyes fully open. You're not making a decision that's going to consider and think about the impacts or the ramifications of your decision on the whole of Alaska, and not just your own district or what you might think of as your own district and being only made up of a certain race or a certain demographic of people.
Thank you. And this is a question for both you and Mr. Turkey, if he's still on the line with us. Can you talk about why it may be problematic for the state to address equity and inequity issues in lawsuits?
Sure, Chair, very interesting question.
spoke about earlier, you have to consider the partner favorite one over another. About the value of education for a student who lives in rural Rochester is less important than the value of education that's the one who lives in rural or urban Rochester. That my son's education is less important than someone who lives in Anchorage. That his right to teach at public safety is less important. And so many times when you're talking about reducing the inequities and the red lines through the court system, as Mr. Fickey said, you know, it's often taken out into something that needs a symbol. And addressing inequity can start at a lower level, can start at a better level, but it doesn't force an action. Draw on something that requires a little more finesse. But keeping your blinders off and seeing that if your decision is favoring one group over another, is it really serving the people who are asking to play it?
Any other questions or committee members? Representative Evans, thank you for trying to have some comments. Thank you for your presentation. And I'm glad that you chose the story from a method of communicating the message. I mean, I believe that's very rare than a lot of charts and figures because the data here is very impersonal. And it doesn't get us to think beyond the facts of figures and realize that the decisions that we're making are impacting people, not just numbers on a page. One of the reasons that I asked to be on this committee and I had to become this committee was because I wanted to stretch my own understanding. In my district, I have about 4% of Alaska Native, so any political advantage for me being here is pretty small. But I do have tribal presence, and I still know that they have had to fight for their subsistence rights. Government that they fish there for generations because of health inequity. So I am gaining an understanding that I also have Russian community who is fighting for equity for a school that they need, that they have yet to receive funding for. And that is a struggle that they feel discriminated against because of having to have only, they're having about 43 to 45 students, and they have to have to build a school in their area because it's not a switchback and not technically a road, and you have to drive along the beach to get there. So there are similar situations, but when we talk about inequity and discrimination and those conversations, we find a position because it is initially telling us that the way we think and the way we see the world is wrong. And no one needs to be told that they're wrong. And it takes an incredible will to be able to lay that down and say, let me come over to our understanding and see the world from your place. That was an illustration of, you know, when someone sits, is standing and looks outside and sees a rainbow, you say, look at that beautiful rainbow, and the person across the room says, what rainbow? That's just a storm cloud in your face. And you say, no, it's this incredible rainbow, but they cannot see it. Physically incapable of seeing that rainbow. But it isn't until that person comes and stands in the place of the person seeing the rainbow that it becomes visible. And I think that is an accurate description of the inequality that comes to our rural villages in Alaska. Is the majority of legislators do come from Anchorage in the Valley. They come from the road system because of the population. And it isn't until we choose to step out of that urban mindset to see the world from a rural perspective that any of that will change. And so
these are challenging and difficult questions, but I see it as well worth that journey. And thank you for talking about these difficult things, because I think Alaska is on a journey to providing true equality. And I ask for your patience for those of us who are in the process, because just in this past year, being on this committee, have gained an even greater understanding of so many things that I didn't see before. I deal with my dad working away from home from the time I was in junior high, and I really hated that. He told me one time he worked for Native corporations in rural Alaska, and he was going through lots of time. And he was painting lines or taking plants. He had great systems in building health centers. He worked in a school during maintenance. And he told me as a young girl, that he was part of something greater in providing for Alaska Natives to have a basic of running water. And that made the sacrifice worthwhile, because he wanted the same things in rural Alaska. And that began my journey of the different perspective. And now I'm having to tell my children. It does take sacrifice, it does take us being willing to be vulnerable and work through difficult things. And there will be conflicts and fights over silly things like the state block. But hopefully we can get to working together on so many deeper issues that will bring the change that is needed for the healing for Alaska Natives. We hope to be a part of that. So thank you for your presentation. So we had a lot of conversation this morning about the concepts related to equity and inequity on a theoretical level, which is so important with regard to the perspectives that legislators bring into the decisions that we make. I kind of want to pivot back over to the firm policy positions as it relates to equity. And Mr. Turkey, you had brought forward the letter that was sent to the Governor and the Attorney General last July with regard to the veto of the RAA school construction dollars. Can you speak to what may happen if the vetoed RAA construction dollars from last year are not restored?
Pretty, you know, this is taking a
understand from a legal perspective, we know that we're focusing on the OAU construction bid. But I've also recognized that really, when it comes to grants, from a court's perspective, does this apply to making sure that the grants are equally distributed to the schools as well? Last year, we were getting an update from education and sports grants that were awarded, and there was I think it was a pre-K kindergarten grant, one-time grant, and it was about $6 million. I asked how to determine the recipients of that grant, and I assumed that it was based upon need, and that's that, about 34% of our students are not ready for kindergarten, and I thought, well, there's going to be a large group of rural communities who could use that money to help get kids get to that level. And the conversation was, it was, give us a creative idea how you're going to use this, and then that's how they awarded the grant. And thinking about the need, I was highly frustrated that it sounded, and this was my limited perspective, and I don't really need any assumption from the people giving the grant, but my perspective was that we weren't putting it through a good measure of the best use of that money when those schools who came up with a creative idea were already firing at a really great place. They were the ones that were already going to be providing good opportunities just because they had that brainpower capacity, where other schools who needed that extra help and encouragement and ideas on how to be able to reach their kids could have used that money. And perhaps that's a larger issue that we can look at, is providing some type of framework for the state and how it distributes educational grants. So that's where I'm just focusing on this RIA construction fund, and other areas of funding are left out there, and we're keeping the same thing as well as case addressed. Because obviously, grants distribute large amounts of money, and we don't want to the ones who have the most political power.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Trippi and Ms. Blake, for your gift to me today. Your episodes of a good foundation which us as a committee and in our relationship with colleagues to have conversations about equity can be made more accountable and more available and less polarizing. Mr. Zippy, as you mentioned, from an attorney's perspective, polarizing and adversarial. So we appreciate, Mr. Zippy, your expertise and your experience that you shared with us this morning. We saw the book. We always appreciate your presence and willingness to help inform the work of our committee. So thank you for that. Our next meeting of the Special Committee on Tribal Affairs will be Tuesday, March 3rd at 8 a.m. in Capitol Room 106. The time is 9:30 a.m. and the hearing is by Oscar.